You're listening to Inside Health, which was first broadcast on BBC Radio 4 on the 22nd of September 2020. I'm James Gallagher, the BBC's health and science correspondent, and we're devoting the whole of this edition to blood clotting. This is partly due to COVID-19, as exceptionally sticky, clot-prone blood has emerged as an unexpected symptom of the disease. But this process is far bigger than COVID. The fact our blood clots is both life-saving and one of our biggest killers. A clot is like a biological plumber fixing our leaking blood vessels. If you cut yourself, it's the clot that stops you bleeding to death. But clotting is a finely tuned process that can go wrong. Clots can form where they shouldn't. Thromboses, clots inside our body's arteries and veins, can be deadly. Those that form in the arteries around the heart or in the brain can block the supply of oxygen. They're more commonly known as a heart attack or stroke. Clots in the veins get less attention, but they can still be deadly when bits break off and lodge elsewhere in the body. Let's find out more with Beverly Hunt, a professor of thrombosis and hemostasis at King's College London.
If you have a blood clot in an artery, you will lose the blood supply to the area supplied by the artery. So, for example, a stroke is when you block one of the arteries in your head and you lose the blood supply to a piece of brain. A heart attack is when you block the blood supply in an artery to part of the heart. And then you've got clots in veins, slightly different in that if you get a clot in the deep vein of the leg, you won't lose your leg, but that bit of leg that's drained by that vein will tend to get a bit swollen and might turn blue or might have very few symptoms at the time. And then the real problem with a deep vein thrombosis is that part of it can break off and travel around the body and block the blood supply to the lungs. And that's a pulmonary embolism, a clot in the lung.
And that could be quite dangerous, can't it?
It can. I mean, we have quite a high death rate due to pulmonary emboli. If you look at blood clots, we know that they are actually responsible for 1 in 4 deaths globally. And the number one really is heart attacks. The number two is strokes. But number three is pulmonary emboli.
Are the risk factors different for those blood clots that form in arteries and the ones that form in veins? Because they're very different blood vessels forming very different jobs in the body. And, you know, like things like blood pressure is very different. You know, the size of the blood vessels is very different.
So, yes, if you think about the risk factors for arterial clots, they are smoking, perhaps being overweight and diabetic, hypertension. But for the veins, it's a whole different ball game. The three risk factors for having clots in the veins, they are immobility, because the veins, they can't push the blood on like the arteries can. They haven't got a muscular wall. They're absolutely dependent on the surrounding muscles in the leg to push on the blood. So immobility, you get blood getting pooled in your leg. Then you've got sticky blood, making the blood more sticky in a number of ways. And lastly, changes in the lining of the blood vessel, known as the endothelium.
Can I be honest? Talking to you is making my legs go twitchy because I'm just thinking of blood clots forming in my legs while I'm sat down in a radio studio.
I'm very pleased to hear it. During lockdown, certainly talking to patients in clinic, I was trying hard to encourage people to stay mobile. And we have seen one or two cases of people who have had DVT because of really very marked immobility.
How would you know if you were having a deep vein thrombosis or even in the later stages of pulmonary embolism, if that clot had travelled to the lungs? I mean, what would be the warning signs?
So in the old-fashioned surgical textbooks, we've got pictures of people with huge swollen legs, very red. But in actual fact, 80% of deep vein thrombosis just present with unexplained pain in the muscles.
And we'll come back to Professor Beverly Hunt to talk COVID before the end. But for now, I want you to meet Edward Taylor, who's 24. But he was just 15 years old when a blood clot changed his life. It started one morning when he woke up with extreme pain in his left leg.
I thought, oh, maybe I've just kind of twisted it in the night. Didn't think anything much of it. And then I got to school and I could feel my whole body just getting worse and worse. And I could feel it throbbing as well, my left leg. My whole body was just going like a completely different colour. And my leg was like blowing up like a balloon.
How big was it getting?
It's like when you slowly blow a balloon up, it's kind of just sort of slowly growing. You could sort of see it just getting angrier and angrier. Mum obviously could see that I was in a lot of distress. So we went straight down to minor injuries, local to me. Got seen by a doctor and said, basically, you've sprained it, put some ice on it, elevate it and stuff. So I carried on doing that for a few more days.
Did you know in your heart of hearts that this was more than a sprain?
Yeah, I kind of went along with it, but wasn't eating at all, was kind of feeling quite sick. We then booked another appointment, but this time at the emergency doctors. And the guy, as soon as I walked in there, he knew straight away what it was. He said, get yourself straight down to A&E. Went straight to A&E, had tests done. Obviously came back as a large blood clot from my groin down to my leg. So I was then put into a ward for the week on blood thinning medication. So it kind of acts as a deterrent from blood clots, but it's also thinning your blood at the same time. So it stops any more clots from happening. So every time I was taking that, it was obviously stopping me from getting another clot.
People are most at risk of deep vein thrombosis once they reach the age of 60. So Ed was exceptionally unlucky to get one at just 15. But then 2 years later, he had another. Eventually, doctors discovered Ed had a rare condition that meant the veins in his leg were being squashed by his pelvis, and that made it easy for clots to form. It's caused long-term damage to his body.
I've got post-thrombotic syndrome in the leg, where the blood basically pulls to the bottom of your ankle and causes a lot of inflammation and swelling. That can turn into ulceration, which I've had, unfortunately. And obviously, you'd only find ulceration as well in older sort of people.
Do you feel old before your time?
Literally. It's funny you ask that question. I have to attend a leg ulcer clinic local to me. And when I turn up there, I'm the youngest patient there. And all of them are quite shocked as well to see a young patient in the clinic, because it's a thing that older people get.
The symptoms, dangers and need for early treatment of heart attacks and stroke have all been drilled into us for decades. But the same's not really true for deep vein thrombosis. These clots normally form in one leg, and the symptoms include swelling, hard and sore veins, as well as throbbing and pain. Dan Horner, a consultant in emergency and critical care medicine at Salford Royal NHS Foundation Trust, specialises in the diagnosis and management of deep vein thrombosis. He says both the public and doctors need to be more alert to the symptoms.
Pulmonary embolism in particular can be really challenging to diagnose, and it can present with shortness of breath, a fast heart rate. Just a collapse episode or a faint of unknown cause can sometimes be the precursor to pulmonary embolism. And those kind of symptoms really should prompt assessment by a medical practitioner so that venous thromboembolic disease can be considered, investigated and treated early. And that's how we'll get the best outcomes.
How often is it that when a patient comes in that they're going to have a deep vein thrombosis? Because a swollen leg could be anything.
That's right. So there are lots of things that can cause symptoms that mimic the presentation of deep venous thrombosis. We tend to see a positive diagnosis in between 10 and 20% of the patients that we investigate. So for every 10 patients that we assess for DVT, only one or two will turn out to have the disease. And in other patients, we usually find another diagnosis, or it's difficult to attribute the symptoms to any particular cause.
Okay, how are we going about getting better at identifying them?
We know that DVT can present in a variety of different ways, and some patients only just get pain in the leg without any swelling or skin changes or any other subtle signs of disease. And for those patients, sometimes the patients themselves will not be aware of the condition of DVT, so they won't necessarily seek advice or help. Sometimes the clinician won't necessarily be aware that DVT can present with just pain without any other structural changes. So there are lots of societies that are pursuing educational campaigns and awareness-raising initiatives, such as the National Institute for Clinical Excellence in the UK, but also worldwide charities such as Thrombosis UK, who are trying to drive up the awareness of the signs and symptoms that can precipitate DVT, with the hope that more patients will then seek medical attention in the early stages of disease and get appropriate diagnoses.
And what new technologies are coming along that can improve this ability to diagnose deep vein thromboses even more?
At the moment, when we're looking at clots in the leg, we use primarily ultrasonography. And when we're looking at clots in the lung, we tend to use CT imaging scans. But both those types of imaging are good at telling us when a pipe is blocked, if you like, but they don't really tell us the age of the clot or the extent of the clot and its progression. And there are advances in the literature at the moment whereby people are using novel techniques such as magnetic resonance imaging and direct thrombus imaging to characterise the age of blood clots themselves. And that can be really helpful to patients and clinicians. If someone's had an old blood clot but they've got residual symptoms, it can sometimes be very hard with our current imaging modalities to tell whether that patient has a new clot that might warrant the use of anticoagulation lifelong, or whether they've just got symptoms related to an old clot. And at the moment, we would often err on the side of caution and prescribe extra therapies. But if we can find an imaging modality that will give us a more exact idea about clot age and development, then we can perhaps avoid that therapy and we can reduce the overall risk for patients.
Treatment is based around dissolving clots that are already there and preventing new ones from forming. This involves drugs that thin the blood, called anticoagulants, and for years, warfarin had been the pill of choice. It is, however, a tricky drug to use. It can cause internal bleeding, and even what you had for dinner can alter how warfarin works. Dr. Dan Horner was part of the team that drew up new guidelines for the NHS on how these clots should be treated.
So that's right. I mean, the evidence base around the use of anticoagulation is to reduce the recurrence of blood clots, so to stop the extension of the one that's there and to stop it breaking off and travelling to other areas of the body. But whilst the anticoagulant is working, the aim is to give the body a natural period during which it can try to break down that blood clot that's in the venous system. I mean, warfarin does work in terms of reducing the recurrence of blood clots, but the challenges have always been the drug-drug interactions and the inconvenience for patients to have to come back and have regular blood tests to make sure that their warfarin levels are therapeutic and to have necessary dose adjustments. So we do still use warfarin for patients who are particularly complex because we know that the therapy works. And there are a new class of drugs now available to treat deep vein thrombosis, such as the direct oral anticoagulants, which are tablet form but don't really require the same monitoring obligations. They don't necessarily have the same drug-drug interactions, meaning they're less complicated medicine to take. And actually, the evidence would suggest that the rates of major bleeding and clinically relevant non-major bleeding are lower with these new drugs. So patients have a more convenient and a safer experience with these therapies. And when we looked at the evidence within the NICE guideline, the clinical and cost effectiveness of these drugs was superior to warfarin. And so NICE has made a recommendation to use them as first line. Some patients who've been on warfarin for a long period of time are very comfortable using it and they prefer it. And of course, this decision about what anticoagulant therapy you take needs to be a balanced one between the patient and the clinician to ensure that it's a shared decision going forwards.
But even long after the treatment is over, a deep vein thrombosis can have a lasting effect on people's mental health. You have to live with the knowledge that you're vulnerable to them again in the future. And the symptoms of a panic attack can actually be very similar to those of a blood clot. Here's Ed again.
I still, like today, I still do struggle with doing certain things, even if that's just wanting to go out with friends. I kind of have to sort of think to myself, I just can't do this. I need to rest and I need to sort of elevate my leg and just kind of sort of relax, because sometimes it gets to you. And I've sort of, obviously, it's given me a lot of depression over time. So I'm on, obviously, antidepressants for it, because it kind of stops you from doing day-to-day things. It gets to you, the pain, and just not a nice thing to be going through, like I say, from a young age.
Massive fingers crossed for you in the future. I mean, I'm hoping that as all the surgery happens and the medication, things will be easier going into the future, right?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
The psychological impact of deep vein thrombosis is a massively understudied area. But one of the people trying to do something about it is Dr. Rachel Hunter from Swansea University.
I think it's important to say that there isn't always a mental health impact, you know, for everyone. Not everyone is going to experience mental health concerns, in particular anxiety, after having a blood clot. But my research has suggested that a significant number of people who have a blood clot may go on to have some anxiety related to that. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that, really. One is because blood clots can really come completely out of the blue, and often people feel, you know, quite unprepared for that event. So it's quite unexpected, and there can also be quite a high risk to their life. So in that sense, it's understandable that people feel pretty anxious after they've experienced a blood clot. But I think there's another reason as well, which is that, you know, once you've experienced a blood clot, it does kind of place you at a higher risk of having further blood clots in the future. And, you know, I think most people who have a blood clot would then become aware of this. So it automatically makes people feel a little bit more anxious.
So is it that switch from thinking you're perfectly healthy to going, actually, I might have a long-term health problem, you know, my blood could be a ticking time bomb?
Absolutely. I think any illness that comes out of the blue can have quite a profound effect on the way we sort of see our life or understand the world or particularly think about our health. Definitely.
Now, you quite rightly said right at the beginning that not everybody has a problem. But do you know how common it is?
I think it's an area of research that is really lacking, and we haven't got really strong figures about the numbers of people who experience them. But the research that I was involved in pointed to quite a significant proportion of people, up to 50% of people who'd experienced blood clots were experiencing some form of psychological distress associated with that. But in particular, that was anxiety or hypervigilance to physical symptoms. So they became very tuned in to symptoms of breathlessness, for example, or feeling of a tightness in their chest. And the tricky thing about that is that mirrors the symptoms of anxiety. So people became very confused about whether they were actually just having anxiety or a panic attack, or if they were experiencing a blood clot on the lung. So that was one of the important themes that people highlighted.
So if a panic attack and some of the side effects of a blood clot can be so similar, I mean, you must be going in and out of hospital quite a lot if you're suffering badly from anxiety.
Yeah.
Just to be sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember talking to one patient who told me that she felt like she had her doctor on speed dial because she was phoning up to check in with her symptoms and feeling so anxious all of the time. So you can imagine how challenging and upsetting it is to live in that sort of emotional state all of the time. And that helps us get a real insight into what it can be like for people who are experiencing anxieties around blood clots and the symptoms associated with them.
It sounds quite tricky as well for doctors at times, because it'll be the same for them having patients arriving with, is it anxiety? Is it a panic attack? Is it another case of a clot going to the lungs causing their breathlessness? I mean, it sounds challenging for both sides.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the difficulties. It is challenging to differentiate those symptoms sometimes. And it can be really hard for patients because they can feel misunderstood and they can feel that they're not being supported. But I think you're right. I think it is a real challenge. So I think there's a lot of work to do, really, in raising awareness and helping health professionals understand the experience of the patient and to really understand the thought processes that their patients may be going through.
Dr. Rachel Hunter. Right at the start of the episode, I said COVID-19 was leading to people developing unusually sticky blood. In March, coronavirus was sweeping the country and doctors noticed a surge in clotting problems. This included clots in the legs and the lungs. Professor Rupen Arya is the director of King's Thrombosis Centre.
The effects of the virus and the consequent thrombosis we are seeing is truly extraordinary. Overall, for example, in the peak months, we were seeing three times as many pulmonary embolism as we might usually expect to see. And the effects were blood clots both in the arteries and the veins, including, for example, heart attacks and strokes in the arteries. But predominantly, 80 to 90% of the cases affected the veins, where we were seeing pulmonary emboli as well as DVTs in the legs. So this really seemed a genuine phenomenon linked to the COVID-19 infection.
One of Rupen Arya's patients was 71-year-old Brian McClure. He was taken to hospital in April after he developed pneumonia and was struggling to breathe.
I was having difficulty walking without getting short of breath. I didn't have loss of smell. I didn't have the dry cough. But it was trouble breathing that really made me feel I had to do something.
And while you were there, they needed to look at your lungs, didn't they, to have a scan? What did that show?
It showed that I had pulmonary embolism, and that's when I knew that I had something serious. I was certainly worried about dying, and I was determined that I was going to get through it.
Did doctors say how dangerous a position you were in with the clots of the lungs? I mean, what were they saying?
I went for pressurised oxygen treatment, and I was told that when I went for that, if that didn't prove effective, I'd have to go for intubation, which is intensive care. And if I went for that, I would have a 50-50 chance of recovering. I went for the pressurised oxygen, which was quite challenging because I was strapped into a very tight-fitting oxygen mask for 24 hours, and I didn't get any sleep at all. But I stayed with it, and that helped me to start breathing properly again and get oxygen back into my blood so that I could start walking without having to take an oxygen cylinder with me.
Was that the moment you turned the corner?
Yes, that's when I started to recover.
And how are things now?
Now, my health's pretty good. I'm having follow-up treatment. I have had anticoagulants, which have helped reduce the clotting and keep that under control. I should be ending that by the middle of October. And I'm taking a lot of exercise. I like walking. I'm doing a lot of walking. And I think that's really helping. And in many ways, I feel fitter than I've felt for quite some time.
And it's good to hear Brian is recovering well. Now, COVID not only led to more clots, but it led to unusual ones too. A typical pulmonary embolism is caused by a chunk of clot breaking off and travelling round the body to the lungs. But doctors were noticing so-called microclots forming directly in the lungs and elsewhere in the body. Professor Jeffrey Lawrence, a haematologist at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City, was one of the first to notice these really small clots.
I got a phone call one afternoon from a dermatologist that said that they had a young man in the intensive care unit. He's on a ventilator, and the nurses were rotating him, and they noticed they had a funny rash on his bottom. And the dermatologist was called to biopsy it, and she looked at it, and she said it's very unusual. The rash that he had was an extensive clot in the small blood vessels in his buttocks. But the very next day, I get a phone call from the autopsy room saying that the pathologist was doing an autopsy on a man who came in and basically died within a few hours. He had a living will. He didn't want to be put on a respirator. And they were doing an autopsy, and they noticed that he had unusual small blood vessel clotting in his lungs. And he's had these unusual clotting problems in his skin. So right away, I knew we had an issue. And from then, it really kind of ballooned, to the point where some of the nurses were calling me and saying, we have to do something, because they couldn't even draw blood. The blood was clotting in the line that they were drawing it from. And so we recognized, this is not your ordinary intensive care unit patient. This is not your ordinary clotting problem that you see in a hospital setting. This is something that's quite more devastating.
We sometimes forget COVID-19 has been around for less than a year. We're constantly learning more about the virus and the disease it causes. This includes figuring out why the blood goes so gloopy and finding ways of countering it. Professor Beverly Hunt, who we spoke to right at the start, says it's the immune system going into overdrive that's causing the blood to become so sticky. And that gives us clues to treatment.
There's some profound inflammatory response to the COVID virus in the lungs, to the pneumonia, which is turning on the coagulation factors, and it's infecting the cells that line the blood vessels as well. And part of that is that there are messages going to the liver to say, produce more coagulation factors. So when we look at the levels of the clotting factors, they would be 200, 300, 400% compared with normal. Quite honestly, I've never in a very long career seen anybody, any group of patients with such sticky blood.
So just to be clear, in your extensive clinical experience, this is as sticky as you've seen blood?
It's the stickiest I've seen a group of patients.
I think what some people will wonder is it just the stickiness or is there more going on as well? Because you've got people with severe COVID tend to fit into certain groups. Elderly, there's a high risk of severe COVID if you're obese. But also someone on ventilation, sedated, they're lying down in bed for what could be a considerable length of time. I mean, all that will increase the risk as well, won't it?
You're right. The stickiness is a combination of what COVID is doing to the patient and the fact that the people who get moderate and severe COVID tend to be older. And as you get older, your blood gets stickier. And we know that in obesity, you've already got sticky blood. So we've got multiple factors there. And I can't think of another virus that has got such a potent effect on the stickiness.
And if this is coming from the immune system, or partly that inflammation, the immune system going into overdrive, is that what you need to treat, or is it enough to just pump lots of anticoagulants into these patients?
I think that if we can reduce the immune response, then we should see less clotting. And we know that the recovery trial, which was run in the UK, showed that if you give anti-inflammatories, if you give dexamethasone, you reduce mortality by about a third. And I suspect we'll see less clots in those individuals.
So is there now more work going on to investigate anticoagulants in specific in these trials?
Absolutely. So in the UK, our chief medical officer has only allowed us to do two trials, which is recovery for the ward patients and REMAP CAP for the intensive care patients. And REMAP CAP now has an anticoagulation arm where we're giving big doses of heparin versus standard doses to see whether a bigger dose will improve outcome. And that is also being extended now to the ward patients.
Is there a danger, though, particularly with those really high doses that you were talking about, of the side effects of increasing the risk of bleeds?
Absolutely. And that's why we need to do trials, because if you give a bigger dose, you probably would reduce thrombotic rates, but you need to make sure that that's not being counteracted by an increase in bleeding rates. So that's the whole purpose of the trials, to see if the benefit outweighs the risks.
So given how exceptional COVID is it teaching us things we didn't know about clotting before? What are we learning from it?
I think for many doctors globally, they have woken up to the fact that hospital admission is associated with deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism, and it may be particularly bad with COVID. I would like to go back and look at other viral pneumonias and look at what rates of DVT and pulmonary embolism they have with them, because I don't think we've ever really looked at them before. And what's happened with viral pneumonias, we usually get one or two admissions, never 200 on ventilators, which brings home what's happening to them very quickly. So it would be nice to go back and look more widely at other diseases and look at their rates of DVT and pulmonary embolism.
Professor Beverly Hunt. That's it for our Sticky Blood special on Inside Health. The producer was Adrian Washburn. Next time, we ask why COVID is so different in children and if they already have some immunity.